His family has a long history in the teams.
Did he skip the country, Fred? Is that why they called us in?
Another SEAL asked.
Well, now, here is where it gets a bit convoluted. You are all going to be asked to sign additional non-disclosures for what is about to happen.
Really? Smitty piped in. More non-disclosures? You mean the 100 other ones we signed don't cover this? What the fuck, Senior?
Just listen up, Smitty, and let me get through this.
Sorry, Senior.
Okay. This is an unprecedented situation. This SEAL, who, as we can see from what he did at Warcom, is not your typical officer who just does his two platoons and then goes to a staff job for the next 15 to 25 years. This guy knows what he's doing. A SEAL domestic terrorist. It's bound to hit the news soon. They are still calling it an act of terrorism, but that's going to change in short order, and we want to be up and out of here before it does, so it doesn't put him more on edge than he already is. He is still in the country, and the SecDef wants him apprehended as soon as possible.
Fred, I haven't been paying much attention to the West Coast stuff in the news. How many people did he kill at Warcom with that blast?
Asked one of the team's more laid-back guys, who looked like he was in a perpetual state of drunkenness.
That's just the thing. Only two. The Admiral and some L.A. finance guy. The Admiral's aide had his eardrums blown out, but other than that, no one else was injured. Apparently, he wrapped this L.A. guy in an S-vest, took his family hostage, and made him detonate himself in the Admiral's office.
No way,
said the laid-back operator, finally showing signs of waking up.
That's hardcore shit. I'm starting to like this guy.
Cut it out, Paul, Fred said curtly. This is serious business. We cannot underestimate him. This is a mission just like any other. Put the fact that he is a SEAL out of your minds, except in the context that we are going up against a formidable adversary. He's had a lot of the same training that we have and has seen his share of combat. Whatever his beef was with the Admiral and this finance guy is none of our concern. What is our concern? Is planning a mission to kill or capture this HVI, he said, intentionally verbalizing the high-value individual terminology used overseas.
Hey, Fred, you said he was still in the U.S., commented one of the more thoughtful SEALs in the group. How can we go after him here? Doesn't posse comitatus still apply?
That's where the non-disclosures come in, gentlemen. SecDef has suspended posse comitatus through an executive order signed by the president. We will be operating on U.S. soil using all assets at our disposal to kill or capture our target.
What? Can she even do that? Why us?
Why not just use HRT? The SEAL asked, using the acronym for the FBI's elite hostage rescue team.
SecDef wants us. Strain hesitated. She wants us because, according to her intelligence sources, Reese's next target is the president.
Eyebrows went up around the table as the gravity and complexity of the situation unfolded before them. Fred paused, scanning the room.
If anyone has a problem with going after this target or operating on U.S. soil, let me know now.
Nobody moved.
Okay, then. He's in a cabin in the mountains of New Hampshire. I don't know how they know this. The target package is slim. It says single-source human with no technical corroboration. Like I said, this is a weird one. There is a bird waiting on us at NAS Oceania, Fred continued, referencing the Naval Air Station down the road from base. We need to be airborne in an hour. We will cover specifics when we land in Vermont. From there, we will make our way into New Hampshire. There is no time to more fully vet this or let it develop. SecDef wants this done yesterday, and we are the force of choice. Any questions?
Fred looked from one operator to the next. Fred regretted the next words that came out of his mouth as soon as he said them.
You don't have to like it, you just have to do it.
What a dumbass thing to say, he thought.
Smitty, a word, please.
Fred said as the crew got up to grab their gear and head to the airfield. Yes, Senior? Smitty asked as soon as the door was closed.
Smitty, you are one hell of an operator, and I'd want you by my side going through a door any time.
But,
you won't be coming with us on this.
And, the team chief quickly added,
Before you protest or say anything else, this is not your decision. I am ordering you off the mission. I can't have guys that know and respect Reese on this op. I know you understand.
Smitty tried to hide the relief on his face. He was conflicted like never before. He couldn't let his team down, nor could he go after the man he looked up to as the best combat leader he had ever worked with. Someone he would follow into the fires of hell. Taking the decision out of his hands was the sign of a good leader. Smitty simply nodded, bowed his head, and walked from the room without his usual energy. Fred took a breath.
Son of a bitch,
he whispered to no one but himself. Taking another deep breath, he strode from the room to ready his gear. Chapter 64. The Pentagon, Arlington County, Virginia. The story preempted every network broadcast and monopolized the cable news channels. Off-the-record quotes from senior officials at the Department of Defense were used to tease the story, ensuring massive coverage. Anchors gave viewers a countdown to the primetime press conference that would be given by Secretary of Defense Lorraine Hartley, while reporters broadcasting from the dozens of satellite trucks crowded in front of the gates of the Naval Amphibious Base Coronado referenced reports of a domestic terrorist being responsible for the blast that killed decorated SEAL Admiral Gerald Pilsner. At 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, Secretary Hartley strode confidently toward the blue lectern at the Pentagon in a somber black suit. Her face exuded competence and control, a steady hand during these tragic times.
Never let a tragedy go to waste.
All that was missing from the scene, she thought, was the presidential seal on the podium.
My fellow Americans,
she began in a voice devoid of her usual New England accent.
It is with great sadness that I address you today to report yet another case of violent extremism in this great nation. This week, a respected California businessman's family was held hostage by a domestic terrorist who forced the man to wear a suicide vest onto a military installation. This act of terrorism took the life of a great American hero and the commander of all U.S. Navy SEALs, Admiral Gerald Pilsner. Tragically, the admiral's killer was one of his own SEAL officers, a disgraced extremist veteran who faces criminal charges for his negligence as a commander in combat, negligence and incompetence that led to the deaths of over 60 SEALs, Army Rangers, and Army pilots and air crewmen. It was and is the worst special operations disaster in American history. The man responsible for this unprecedented disaster is Lieutenant Commander James Reese. It is thought that his guilt over the ambush in Afghanistan drove him to target Admiral Pilsner, and it is suspected that he is also responsible for several other murders over the past weeks in Southern California, including the atrocious slaying of a peaceful Muslim cleric and another vicious killing just this week in the Florida Keys, where he took the life of another American hero, U.S. Navy Captain Leonard Howard.
Secretary Hartley paused for dramatic effect, the silence broken only by the shutter clicks of the print photographers' cameras.
Lieutenant Commander James Reese is at large and should be considered well-armed and extremely dangerous. A nationwide law enforcement effort to locate and arrest him is already in progress, but, unfortunately, the labors of our brave men and women in law enforcement are being hampered by extremists on the right who have put so-called privacy concerns over the safety of Americans from the scourge of terror. I have asked the President to sign an executive order enacting various emergency measures necessary to catch Mr. Reese and prevent others like him from murdering their fellow citizens. I also call on Congress to act swiftly to pass the Bipartisan Domestic Security Act so that we can all live safely and without fear. Since 9/11, we have looked outward for the threats of terror. This xenophobic focus on so-called foreign terrorists has caused us to overlook the true threats to liberty brewing here at home. Extremists such as Timothy McVeigh, Randy Weaver, Eric Rudolph, and James Reese should be the real targets in our fight against terror. I stand ready to defend this nation from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And with your help, we will bring James Reese to justice, or we will bring justice swiftly down upon him. I'll take your questions.
An attractive female reporter from one of the networks stood and was recognized for a question spoon-fed to her earlier by Hartley's press secretary.
Secretary Hartley, is it true that Commander Reese's pregnant wife and daughter were murdered in their home several weeks ago, and that James Reese is suspected of committing those murders? That's right, Meredith, and yes, we do suspect that he was involved. This also brings up another point about the mental health of our men and women in uniform. Mental health and PTSD are serious issues that we as a nation must address. I call on our scientific community to dedicate their resources to addressing these problems. We need to declare war not on members of our community who are of a certain religion, but on post-traumatic stress disorder. Next question. Yes, Andrew.
Andrew Harrison was a reporter and legal expert for one of the cable news networks.
Secretary Hartley, can you confirm that James Reese used assault weapons with high-capacity clips for some of the murders in California?
Yes, Andrew. We know that he used a military-style AK-47 machine gun with an illegal clip to kill a Muslim-American cab driver in Los Angeles. That man's only offenses were having dark skin and worshiping a different god. Now his wife is without a husband, and his children are without a father. One more question.
William Brantley was the elder statesman of American broadcasters, with a career that spanned back to his time as a young war correspondent in the closing days of the Vietnam War.
Madam Secretary, perhaps this isn't the time for such a question, but you've led this nation steadfastly through so many tragedies. Will you announce for us your intention to run for President of the United States?
Don't lay it on so thick, William. Thanks, William, but this isn't about me. This is about the American heroes who have paid the ultimate price to defend our nation. This is about bringing a terrorist to justice. Thank you all. God bless the victims of these tragedies, and God bless the United States of America.
The secretary stood for a full 5 seconds and stared into the television cameras before turning to exit stage right.
I nailed it.
Angels Camp, California. Katie Buranek watched the secretary's speech, aghast. She was a bit shocked that Reese had apparently turned Mike Tedesco into a human claymore mine in Pilsner's office, but even more, she was disgusted by the outlandish allegations made against him. She could buy that he'd killed Pilsner and Tedesco. God knew they had it coming. But there was no way that he had anything to do with the death of his wife and child. She knew firsthand that the story about Reese murdering the cab driver was a lie, even down to what type of weapon he'd used. She was also confident that Reese was no extremist. He never once mentioned politics in any of their conversations. To paint a hero like James Reese as a xenophobic fascist was an affront to everything she knew about the man and his family, whom she so admired. It was time for her to get in the fight, this time wearing her journalist hat, working an editorial that would likely be the sole voice against the Hartleys' massive public relations machine. Chapter 65. Coos County, New Hampshire. Fred still believed in the Constitution. He had dedicated his life to supporting and defending it. Like many senior enlisted SEALs, Fred had his college degree. Unlike most SEALs, he was also working on a master's degree in philosophy, of all things. He loved history, specifically the history of warfare, but he tempered that with the peace that studying philosophy brought him. His guys sometimes called him the warrior poet, a title he wore with honor. That the president and SecDef had suspended Posse Comitatus bothered him. He was old enough to remember the fiascos that were Waco and Ruby Ridge in the early 1990s. He was just a kid at the time, but remembered the political firestorm that ensued when it was discovered that the advisors had been on the ground assisting the ATF at Waco. Federal government overreach was still something about which most Americans were extremely apprehensive. What had caused Fred even more concern was the group of men who met him and his team at Mount Washington Regional Airport in New Hampshire. 20 private security contractors from a firm called Capstone Security were awaiting him. A call back to his command confirmed that the SecDef had already personally called to ensure the SEALs would support the contractors. The reason for the support role, he was assured, was some legal necessity related to Posse Comitatus. Fred was enraged. This was complete bullshit. These security contractors were not here to apprehend Reese. They were here to assassinate him. Fred knew the law and understood the Constitution. He also knew he had pledged an oath to obey the orders of those appointed over him. It was these two conflicting allegiances that gnawed at his soul. Speeding over mountain roads brought him back to the moment.
"Slow down, Clark," he ordered gruffly. "We need to get to the target in one piece."
The UAV on loan from Department of Homeland Security showed no signs of life at the mountain cabin. Far removed from the paved roads of the New Hampshire countryside, it looked like an idyllic retreat, at least from the feed Fred was watching on the iPad mini in his lap. Fred moved his HK416 rifle to the side and tapped the transmit button on the embitter radio secured in the gear on his plate carrier.
"Lead, slow it down," he cautioned to the first vehicle in the convoy.
They all wore their gray shipboarding kit, minus any flotation, so as not to look overtly military. The gray, nondescript uniforms made them appear more like a big city SWAT team than a group of battle-hardened SEALs. The only giveaway was that each operator's helmet did not match the unexceptional gray of their uniforms and body armor. Operators could become attached to their helmets. Helmets of multicam or AOR-1 Desert Digital camo sat in their laps so as not to alert local citizens that war had come to town.
"What, you getting too old for this, senior?"
quipped one of the newer members of the team from the back seat of the rented Suburban.
"No, I just want us all to arrive at the drop-off point alive."
"Good copy, senior," responded the younger man.
"Hey, senior, why didn't they just use local cops to get this guy? I heard what Smitty said about him being a good operator and all, but..."
"He's only one guy, and he's just a vanilla SEAL," Clark said, using the unofficial, semi-derogatory term used to describe those SEALs and Army SOF operators not in their particular units.
"Hey," Fred responded with more emotion in his voice than he intended. "This guy is not just a vanilla SEAL. And you know I hate that term. He is an HVI, a domestic terrorist. He is our targeted individual. Do not underestimate him. Do you understand?"
"Understood, senior. That goes for everyone," Fred said, clicking his radio once more.
"Listen up, gentlemen. We are 1 hour out. Do not, I say again, do not underestimate this guy."
"Good copy,"
came the trail vehicle's reply. Fred settled back into his seat. The rental Suburban and Tahoe would get them as far as a drop-off point on the opposite side of a steep mountain behind the cabin. From there, they would patrol in to observe from high ground. Then they would make entry under the cover of darkness and apprehend America's most famous domestic terrorist. Reese knew they would come. He didn't know how many or exactly when, but he knew they would come. He spent little time pondering whom they would send. Would it be private contractors? A possibility, considering the resources of the conspiracy in which he found himself an unwitting pawn. Local sheriff? Reese hoped not. FBI hostage rescue team? A probability, considering they had the authority to operate on U.S. soil. Maybe, depending on how desperate the SecDef had become. Whoever came for him was a part of that conspiracy. They were coming to prevent him from completing his mission, and that was something Reese could not allow. Reese felt no allegiance to anything or anyone. His sole purpose was to make those who killed his family account for what they had done. They had taken everything from him. Now it was his turn. When they came for him, the last piece of the puzzle would fall into place. Reese prayed he was wrong, but even before he heard the helicopter, he knew he was not. His pursuers were instruments of a group of conspirators who had subverted the system for their own benefit. Power and money were formidable motivators to those in life with no purpose other than their own self-aggrandizement. Had Reese died in Afghanistan, as they had planned, his family would still be alive. Horn and his cronies would be more wealthy than most ever dreamed possible. Admiral Pilsner would